This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time for sports. The St. Louis Cardinals are now a game away from the World Series. Will the Tigers claw their way back against the Rangers tonight? Who will win this week's NFL battle of two undefeated teams who are on the rise? Will there be basketball for Christmas? Why don't I stop asking all these questions and let NPR's Tom Goldman come in? Morning, Tom.
You expect me to answer all that?
In order, if you can recall them, my friend. Listen, 7-1 St. Louis over Milwaukee last night. What happened?
This is an audio representation of what happened. Oops. Oops, yeah. I dropped something. Scott, errors happened. Milwaukee is not a good defensive team. And the Brewers picked a rotten time to show it. They committed four errors. The worst was a grounder between infielder Jerry Hairston's legs. He looked like a croquet wicket. It came with two outs in the second inning, and it allowed two runs to score. That really set a bad tone for Milwaukee. St. Louis hit the ball well. Their relief pitching was great. Yeah. Now it's back to Milwaukee, where the Brewers have the best regular season home record, but the Cards have won four of their last five in Milwaukee, looking pretty good for St. Louis.
Of course, Rangers are going to try and do what they couldn't accomplish on Thursday, which is to finish off the Detroit Tigers and go on to the World Series.
Yes, they have not been dropping things. The Rangers are up 3-2. They have two chances in Texas to win one game. And again, you have to like the Rangers' chances. Detroit is hanging in there, but you have to do more than hang in there, I think, versus this talented, young, and deep Texas team. I mean, Scott, how scary is it for the Rangers' opponents that Nelson Cruz usually bats seventh in the lineup? That's way down there, and all he's done so far is set a league championship series record with five home runs.
I have loved these playoffs. The games, until last night, the games have been close. Some wonderful performances. Yes, and people like Nelson Cruz, who you know, step up at just the right moment. These are all middle of the country. They are middle class teams in baseball's hierarchy. And do we have any indication if the rest of the country is excited as I am?
Well, if you judge by TV ratings, the rest of the country is not excited, and it's ironic, isn't it? You know, baseball prides itself on having parity. Revenue sharing appears to be working. As you mentioned, opening day payrolls for these four teams range from 10th to 17th, yet national TV ratings are down a reported 15% for the first round of the playoffs. Reports on the current league championship series is that the national ratings are even lower. It's got to be frustrating for Major League Baseball.
Briefly, let's dabble in football. The Lions and the 49ers are the marquee game this week. I mean, a couple of years ago, you'd have to give away tickets to that match.
I tell you, you know, 5-0 Lions versus 4-1 49ers, both finished last season at 6-10. And of course, we're only 3 years removed from the Lions' 0-16 embarrassment. Again, parity. And you know, to shift to yet another major sport, Scott, the NBA owners have to be pressing their collective noses against the glass, so wanting the kind of competitive parity they're seeing in the NFL and Major League Baseball.
You know, but I would tell you there is something to be said for having a standard of excellence. You know, when the Bulls had their great run of six championships, for that matter, you know, when the Yankees and the Red Sox, when the Celtics and the Lakers, I think this is a rising tide that lifts fan interest all over.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. Surely fans in Milwaukee and Minnesota say would love to see their teams do well. But this, more than the NFL and Major League Baseball, is a star-driven league, and a league, as you mentioned, whose popularity over the years has been driven by dominant franchises and rivalries between dominant franchises.
Yes or no? Theo Epstein's going to wind up with the Cubs?
Ooh, don't know. It depends on how's that? It depends on compensation. What will the Cubs give the Red Sox? Money, players, both. They sure want him in Chicago, where, as you well know, the drought, the curse, no championship is now stretched several thousand years, I believe.
Yeah, two millennia, if I'm not mistaken.
103, okay. Let's call it that.
All right, NPR's Tom Goldman, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And as we mentioned, according to reports, the Cubs are close to a deal with Red Sox general manager Theo Epstein. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. I suppose that J. Bruce Ismay shouldn't be mentioned in the same breath as any of the true criminals and mass murderers of the 20th century. But for many years, he might have been the most universally despised man in the Western world. J. Bruce Ismay was the proud owner of the Titanic, and he's been portrayed in numerous books and movies.
We have here the largest, most beautiful, and technically perfect ship in the history of mankind. We're not going to need lifeboats.
But they were. And J. Bruce Ismay jumped into one of the last lifeboats to leave and lived. By the time the Titanic survivors reached New York, he was probably the most reviled man on earth. Francis Wilson, a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, has written a book that tries to explain the man reviled by so many, How to Survive the Titanic or the Sinking of J. Bruce Ismay. She joins us from London. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
How did, in fact, he wind up in a boat with survivors?
Well, there are many different versions of Ismay's leaving the Titanic. What Ismay himself said was that he helped to load 8 lifeboats on the starboard side of the ship, and then when the deck was clear, when he could see nobody else, and the second-to-last lifeboat, he called it the last, but it was actually the second-to-last, was leaving the starboard side of the ship, there was an empty place in it, and he jumped in. Everyone who survived, who was then called as a witness to the subsequent inquiries into the Titanic in New York and Washington and in London, was asked firstly to account for their own survival and secondly to account for Ismay's survival. They were all asked, did you see Mr. Ismay? What was he doing? How was he behaving?
Nobody testified that he pushed anyone out. We should understand that, right?
No, that's right. Nobody testified that he pushed anyone out. What Ismay himself said and what he stressed again and again and again was that his status on the Titanic entitled him to a place in a lifeboat because, he said, he was a regular passenger on the ship. He wasn't a member of the crew. The crew, like the captain, were expected to go down with the ship. And this is really what the inquiries focused on. How could he have been a passenger when he didn't pay for his ticket?
Even in this day of instant vilification in media channels, can we understand how intensely unpopular J. Bruce Ismay was?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I hadn't quite got the measure of how unpopular he was when I started this book. I mean, I was interested in writing about him because I was interested in how you lived with that kind of conscience. And then I sort of started to read the newspaper reports, and he was absolutely loathed in America. What seemed to happen with Ismay is that the fantastically complicated story of the Titanic was simplified into a kind of pantomime of one villain and a lot of heroes. And so
the guy who said, yeah, you don't need that many lifeboats. And how do you pick up a life after that?
Well, you can't. I mean, there's a difference between surviving and living. And Ismay was a survivor, and he never picked his life up again. I mean, I think other survivors could start again at some point. I don't think very easily. Ismay certainly couldn't, and his family certainly couldn't. His wife made the fatal error. She thought it was a reasonable thing to suggest that the word Titanic was never mentioned ever in their family again, never mentioned in his presence. What Ismay did do was to confide in another survivor. This is an American woman called Marion Thayer, whose husband, who'd been the vice president of the Philadelphia Railroad, had gone down on the ship. And she wrote him gentle, forgiving letters. And Ismay just poured his heart out to her. So as his marriage was crumbling in England in the year after the Titanic went down, he was becoming more and more and more emotionally dependent on Marion Thayer and sending these letters to her in Philadelphia. And so what's really interesting about these letters is that on the one hand, they're love letters. And on the other hand, their pathetic and infantile, kind of self-absorbed letters. And at one point he says to her, gosh, can you imagine what would have happened to us had the ship not gone and hit the iceberg?
I don't want to give away your last beautifully crafted chapter, but you observe toward the end of it, Ismay is the figure we all fear we might be.
I felt that we'd seen Ismay before. There was something very, very familiar about him. The story of Ismay and the Titanic's a bit Noah's Ark, you know, is a man who builds a ship and just wants to save himself and no one else. Or it's the story of Frankenstein, of the doctor creating the monster who in the end destroys him. We've all had our personal Titanics. We've all had those moments where we really have not shone and we've had to live through and block it out and try to face some kind of future, knowing that we missed an opportunity to be bigger and better than we were. And in that sense, I think, you know, Ismay is every man. Ismay is one of us.
Frances Wilson in London, her new book, How to Survive the Titanic or the Sinking of J. Bruce Ismay. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
A new ESPN documentary called Catching Hell tells the story of how 8 years ago the Cubs came close to winning their first championship in more than a century and how, instead, a fan named Stephen Bartman became a scapegoat. NPR's David Schaefer reports.
There's a part of me that didn't even want to do this story. No Cub fan, including me, wants to relive the night of October 14th, 2003. It still hurts. But here goes. The Cubs were leading the Florida Marlins in the National League Championship Series 3-2 and took a 3-0 lead into the eighth inning. The level of anticipation in Wrigley Field that night was incredible. I was there, covering the game, recording, as the crowd counted down the outs. With one out and a runner on second, the Marlins' Luis Castillo hit a fly ball in foul territory down the left field line. The Cubs' Moises Alou ran over to the stands and reached up with his glove, just as a bunch of fans reached up too, and one of them, 26-year-old Steve Bartman, deflected it, preventing Alou from catching the second out of the inning. Alou went ballistic. Fox TV showed replays over and over. Fans turned on Bartman, booing, chanting obscenities, and throwing beer at him. Back on the field, the Cubs came unglued. The Marlins went on to score 8 runs. 8. And the Cubs lost the game and Game 7 the next night, while the Marlins ultimately won the World Series.
I was pretty PO'd. I threw the remote and I turned the TV off.
At O'Donovan's, a Chicago bar about a mile and a half west of Wrigley Field, 32-year-old David Beaudoin remembers how Bartman's interference rattled the players.
It threw everybody off of their game, you know, and nobody was prepared for that. You know, I mean, you saw Alou's reaction to the whole play. You know, he was furious.
The documentary Catching Hell by Oscar-winning filmmaker Alex Gibney shows how outfielder Alou's outburst on the field sparked a nasty reaction in the crowd. Bartman became a scapegoat and a target. Wearing headphones over a Cubs cap, glasses, and a green turtleneck, Bartman stood out in the crowd, so for his safety, security escorted him from the stadium. The next day, the Chicago Sun-Times published his name, the suburb he lived in, and where he worked. TV crews camped outside of his house. Reporters hunted down his friends, neighbors, and even the Little League team he coached, while Bartman and his family got death threats. He's pretty much gone underground ever since. Cubs fan Mary Beaudoin says she hasn't seen the documentary yet, but she does look back now on the fans' reaction to Bartman with a little remorse.
You know, this poor guy, I mean, it was so much hatred towards him and so many mean things that were said. It was like, he could have been suicidal. I know I would have. All of Chicago now hated you and it was your fault. They blamed him. I kind of did. So...
Husband David Beaudoin adds,
he can be forgiven.
But the film Catching Hell doesn't ask Cubs fans if they can forgive Bartman. Rather, it asks if Bartman can ever forgive his fellow fans.
I think they reacted very poorly. I really do.
Lifelong Cub fan Patricia Reardon, who grew up in the shadows of Wrigley Field and is now in her 70s, seems embarrassed by the scorn her fellow fans directed at one of their own.
Poor guy. I feel sorry for Bartman, and it was a very sad situation for Chicago and Bartman.
Patricia's daughter, 50-year-old Julianne Reardon, agrees, and she blames the media for fueling the fire.
They've played that one play over and over and over again, and then they gave his name out, and then they told what he did. They divulged so much information about him.
In Catching Hell, documentary writer and director Gibney compares Chicago's scapegoating of Bartman to that of Boston Red Sox first baseman Bill Buckner, whose error in the 1986 World Series led to his team's collapse and Red Sox fans to run him out of town. Buckner was exonerated when the Red Sox won World Series titles in 2004 and 07, and he's now cheered by most Boston fans. Could the same soon happen at Wrigley now that Theo Epstein, the general manager who assembled those Red Sox championship teams, appears headed to Chicago? Again, Julianne Reardon.
They have to reconstruct the team. You know, they had a horrible year this year, but we still keep going back for more. More grueling punishment.
Cubs fans, even Steve Bartman, I hope, are nothing if not eternally optimistic. David Schaefer, NPR News, Chicago.